Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the Creekside Room, Jackie Brolsma is speaking on why the war on drugs is failing. So let's listen in on Jackie Brolsma.
This is a session on why the drug war has failed. My name is Jackie Brolsma, and I'm a mental health nurse practitioner. I've worked in drug and alcohol treatment and research for almost 20 years now in a variety of settings, both rural Midwest and Indian reservation and private treatment centers. And currently I live and work in Seattle, a downtown drug clinic treating primarily heroin addicted people, who of course also abuse cocaine, alcohol, and other substances. But we also do ongoing research there. And so I guess tell you that because I really approach this topic from the front lines and not as a policymaker or a sociologist. And it's merely out of interest, I think, that I've gotten more curious about the strategies that we use to deal with drugs in this country. And I guess I can't just look at the symptoms on a day-to-day basis of the drug scene and not be concerned with the root causes and ignore the justice issues involved. So it's one of interest, not of expertise. So I hope to just try to address some of the themes involved in our drug policies, and it's going to be far from a comprehensive look at it, but I'll highlight some of the things that have been sort of the main ways we've attacked the problem and why it's failed, and then talk about new directions that we ought to be going. I was struck to read a quote that Richard Nixon made in July of 69 when he said, "Of all the wars the U.S. has fought since 1945, not one has enjoyed the popularity as the war on drugs." And the polls show that people are more afraid of drugs than they are unemployment or the deficit. And drug enforcement, in fact, is really one of the few government services for which people say they're willing to pay higher taxes for. And this consensus seems to cross racial, gender, ideological, and geographical lines, probably even religious. But it should really come as no surprise, and as one writer, I think, puts it well, the horrors of drug abuse are so lavishly documented that in a single day it's possible to hear a report in Good Morning America about a Coast Guard marijuana seizure off Savannah, Georgia, then read in the morning paper about a drive-by shooting in LA, glance at a drug-free workplace poster over the water fountain, listen to a call-in radio confessional about addiction, catch up on Richard Dreyfuss's battle against cocaine while waiting in line at Safeway, hear from the kids about their DARE drug education program at school, watch a, quote, kingpin brought to justice on Miami Vice, pop in a video of New Jack City, and wind up the day by participating in a crack house raid on the 10 o'clock news. So this sort of war that we experience almost on an entire day basis continues to be waged today with really very, very few winners and many, many losers. And really what's ignored is one paradox anyway, and that's that the U.S. in the name of national security has had a historical pattern of collusion with drug merchants. And I'll just highlight some of the CIA and drug trafficking. There's many instances reported in Senator Kerry's report, I think it was 88 or 89, Senate subcommittee where foreign policy considerations and the intelligence community have obstructed drug enforcement efforts. The State Department has contracted services from companies with drug connections in Costa Rica and Honduras. And declassified government documents illustrate a working relationship between drug entrepreneurs and the U.S. intelligence agencies really since the end of World War II. We heard about the French connection broken in 1970, and the Southeast Asian CIA gave cash and arms to Laotian, National Chinese, and the Thai merchants and turned a blind eye to the opium trade, all in the name of sort of fighting communism. And the CIA employed Cuban exiles acting in drug trade as informants and mercenaries in fight against communism in Latin America. And a similar pattern certainly was revealed with Noriega and the Honduran military and the Afghan so-called freedom fighters. So we've sort of had a double standard about this problem.
One thing I've always wondered about that is that it's very hard to get Congress to pass foreign aid to, say, pump $1 billion into a place like Colombia. Mm-hmm. It would seem easy to just relax the drug trade and have $10 billion flow into the country with no problem at all.
Absolutely.
I wonder if some of that wasn't the motivation for government policy.
Could be. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about really why this policy on the drug war has failed. And it's really been based on a three-prong attack that's included eradication, interdiction, and tougher domestic law enforcement. Basically, that's been the strategy, and I'll talk about each of those. And eradication is in the producing countries has dominated our relationship to them, and that's really an effort to sort of eradicate the production of the drug. And we've done that while the urgent issue of perhaps their debt and its impact on their economies has been shunted sort of to the sidelines. And eradication has alienated the growers who see really no viable economic alternative to the growing of either coca or opium. And this method really is viewed as an ethnocidal approach because of the centrality of the growing of these substances to the indigenous culture. And the efforts to eliminate the crop have met continually with failure. The economic incentives remain extremely high and overwhelming, especially when there's very few alternatives. And this policy really fails to address the enduring social conditions that lead to the production. And rather really than seeing, for example, the cocaine industry as a response to the really deep economic problems faced by these countries, the U.S. views the industry as sort of this isolated phenomenon that can be sort of surgically removed with massive military assistance and with even troops if necessary. And it's a very myopic view of the problem. So eradication, right? There's much more that could be said about really how that's failed, but and really what it's done to some of these countries. But the second part of that three-prong attack, interdiction, is really this attempt to sort of keep the drugs out of the country, and or the flow of them at least. And that's through sort of intercepting private planes flying illegal drugs into the country. And this has been incredibly failing. And pilots changed their tactics to dropping bundles of cocaine to high-speed boats offshore. And with increasing technology, it's extremely difficult to do this. And cocaine pilots make a lot of money, somewhere up to $500,000 for a single flight, and are certainly willing to take the risk for that amount of money to do that. Most of them are U.S. citizens with lots of flight experience. Logistically, it's just unrealistic. Drugs are too easy to produce and transport, and the borders are too easy to penetrate. And as one Pentagon report in 1989 estimated that it would really take about one-third of the Navy's fleet, more radar plans than the Air Force has, and 96 Army battalions of over 50,000 troops to halt the flow of drugs into the U.S. So the failure of really these two, the eradication and the interdiction then, has led to this incredible domestic call for a law and order approach to the problem. It's kind of the response then. And as in the producing countries, the victims are those at the bottom of the pyramid, small growers. The small dealers and the user dealers who turn to drugs primarily as an economic alternative in this country are also the victims of that strategy. More Americans are in federal prisons today for drug crimes than were in federal prisons for all crimes when Ronald Reagan took office. And the U.S. has a bigger portion of its population behind bars than any other country. And for women, that's doubled in the last 6 years. And the racial dimensions of this are, I think, just appalling. Half of the Americans in prison today are African Americans, which represent about 1/8 of our population. And that's 5 times that of South African incarceration rates. More American black men are in prison today than are in college. And the Justice Department estimates that by 1995, that's just in another year, more than 2/3 of all the convicts will be inside for drugs. 41% of them now there are for drug arrests. And 1/3 of the drug convictions are blacks, which are not the majority of the drug users. So it's really not a war on drugs, but it's against people who use them, even the casual users. As one writer says, most drug users aren't violent or dysfunctional, the strategy says, but they should be punished anyway because the casual user imparts the message that you can still do well in school or maintain a career and family. For that, Bush wanted casual users imprisoned as criminals, ejected from public housing, deprived of driver's license, and cut off from both student loans and welfare. It's really a war against people. And meanwhile, the drug problem and associated violence really show no sign of diminishing. The pushers are, so to speak, are supposed to be the target, but twice as many people are arrested for just possession, not dealing. So addiction really isn't the government's first concern. Treatment and prevention get less than half of the funding of government, of enforcement. And 4% today we know of addicts have access to treatment. So the goal is really simply to lock people up. In 1992, 2/3 of the $12.3 billion spent at the war on drugs went to interdiction, the criminal justice system, and law enforcement, and only 1/3 went to treatment, prevention, and research combined, if you lump them all together. So it's been greatly skewed. Our priorities have been really misdirected. I want to talk a little bit more about another perspective on this drug war, and then I don't want to say that sort of an awful kind of story forever and ever. I want to talk about some new directions we can go. Another perspective is Americans have, from the very beginning, long in our history, have used drug laws as an excuse to spy on and harass our political and ethnic enemies. The first drug ban ever was explicitly targeted at the opium of the so-called heathen Chinese, and that's a very interesting story if you're ever interested in reading about that. The first marijuana laws were passed by states fearing an immigration wave of the so-called, quote, beat peons from Mexico. And the cocaine, the first banning of that in the South was really to prevent an uprising of so-called hopped-up cocainized Negroes. And that's a whole other part of our history. And even today, this is a recent police, in many states, police are authorized to use controversial drug dealer profiles to stop primarily black and Hispanic motorists they suspect of drug trafficking. And this is, I'm not meaning to pick on New Mexico, but this is taken from a New Mexico profile. For example, instructed police to be aware of Hispanics or blacks between 20 and 35 who appear to be foreign, who are driving too fast or too slow or too cautiously, or who have too much or too little luggage. And then relying on the subjective judgments of police officers, the profile is both vague and contradictory. Looking directly into the eyes of a police officer is grounds for suspicion, yet not looking into the eyes of a police officer is equally suspect. So, we've really exploited this sort of effort. Federal monies from Justice Department have started offering also cuts of the cash, houses, and cars, et cetera, that get confiscated in joint operations. And I know this to be the case. I was sort of shocked everyone in this. And the confiscations have risen like 17-fold in state and local cops get half. For example, in Missoula, Montana, two of the sheriff's 11 detectives are paid by federal drug grant money and assigned full-time to drug cases. So sort of welcome to the free market criminal justice with police dependent on the drug economy. It's hard to see their incentive for really stamping it out if they can benefit from it. So I think I've made the point that the war on drugs has really failed. Spending millions on eradicating drug crops in the third world and stopping drugs at our borders has not ended the supply of illegal drugs in our country. Policymakers have defined the issue as a drug war and as such have limited the parameters of the discussion by doing so. If policymakers saw the problem as a health problem, they'd be restraining instead of supporting the tobacco industry and providing treatment and other health services on demand. I don't know what you, as a physician, Bob, thought of Everett Koop when he was the former U.S. Surgeon General, but I think he had a wonderful quote when he said, "At a time when we're pleading with foreign governments to stop the export of cocaine, it is the height of hypocrisy for the United States to export tobacco." And then he goes on to make this case in relation to the tobacco industry. And I think there's another session this week that's going to be talking about that. But if the problem is one of spiritual bankruptcy, which leads us to seek redemption through physical substances and sensations, we should address the aggressive consumerism and love of power and money so pervasive in our country. And if the problem is the distortion of the economy that the drug trade has wrought, we ought to structure the economy to provide alternatives to street dealers, people in cocoa-producing countries, and other debtor nations. If the issue is the illegal profits that the drug economy gives to some, enforcement would be focused on major traffickers and the enormous surpluses of banks in the U.S. and elsewhere instead of the poorest people in the drug cycle, the growers and the chronic users. If it's simply a matter of keeping harmless substances such as the coca plant from being turned into toxic ones, the U.S. should really just purchase the coca leaves at a fraction of the amount we spend on keeping cocaine from reaching the country. We could just buy all the coca, you know, upright and take care of it and spend less than we do trying to sort of keep it from getting here. We need to view addiction in the U.S. first and primarily as a problem of social health. We really need to shift in terms of the debate on the drug issue. The drug crisis has to be redefined as a social, economic, and public health problem, rather than primarily a law enforcement crisis requiring a war strategy. The ineffectiveness of costly supply-side tactics must be assessed, and the strategy needs to be redirected toward curbing the demand for drugs. That's really where we really failed as a country. The approach to the demand side should be weighted toward education, prevention, and treatment versus law enforcement and punishment. We've got to start looking at it as a criminal problem and one as a public health problem. And I think the law enforcement that's needed, I'm not one to say we don't need it at all, but it can serve as a substitute for the economic, for meaningful social and economic change. And it's certainly the security has to come without sacrificing, you know, civil liberties. So the approach has to be multifaceted. It needs to be rooted in local communities. We need to look at debt relief for many of the countries involved. I think we need to look at ourselves as a new role in international trade. We need to decrease, I think, our military assistance. We've made drastic mistakes arming some of these countries to fight the drug war and end up with many of them misusing it. I think we need to rethink the role of the U.S. in the world. That's not only in relation to this topic, but recognizing really that national security is an economic issue, not a military one. And we have to look more at cooperation, not dominance. The money laundering issue, I think there definitely should be stiffer penalties for against banks and bankers and their board of directors. I think we should work towards internationalization of laws that against money laundering and improve methods for detection. I think the economic reinvestment and the new priorities needs to face the realities of non-white, poor, working-class communities. I think the economic decline in our country, both the farm crisis as well as what's happened in the urban populations, has been fertile ground for the drug economy. I think victims in every society affected by the drug problem, the causes of the victimization might vary for, you know, the cocoa farmer in Peru, or Bolivia, or for the peasant workers in Latin America, or the youth without jobs in the U.S. But the root cause remains an economic system that's really failed these people and failed to provide all of the groups the means to earn a livable wage and enjoy a life which satisfies their most basic needs. I think it's well put when we, as many critics have emphasized, regardless of how many prisons are built, how many opium and coca fields are eradicated, those involved in the drug trade will not just say no to producing, selling, or using drugs until they have something to say yes to: meaningful work, affordable housing, good schools, decent prices for legal crops. I want to stop there and just say that, you know, that's really the bare outlines for some alternatives, but I haven't really addressed the racism that pervades the society and resulting in distorted information about, first of all, who the majority of drug users are, which are not the Black and Hispanic or the poor. The media's portrayal that serves to justify calls for this law and order sort of guns approach. Because in the media, if we portray the enemy as somebody who's already considered less than human, and that justifies continuing to approach it that way. I guess I want to open up to your responses, some of your experiences, comments. Yeah.
What is the profile of the typical drug user?
It's still white. In fact, even more middle class suburban. There's more drug trafficking going on there, but so much of our targeting is in the poor community. I'm not sure. There's a section here that looking at the statistics. Let's see. Of the 14.5 million illegal drug users, approximately 11 million are white.
Mm-hmm.
1.7 million are Black, and 1.2 million are Hispanic. So the racial breakdown is not at all what we get portrayed sort of in the media. And most drug use occurs in white upper and middle class communities, yet in part because of urban minority neighborhoods bear the brunt of drug-related violence. More of the violence takes place there. And tough law enforcement measures, they gain the most media attention. I don't know if that kind of answered the question.
Are there any countries that have attempted to provide drugs basically and get it out of the criminal business?
Well, it's certainly less of a criminal issue I know in Holland. That's probably one of the countries that's talked about a lot. In fact, there's a recent documentary that's been showing in the theaters in Seattle called Sex.
Democracy.
That's it, Sex, Drugs, and Democracy, which I understand is an excellent, in fact, they're surprised that there aren't travel agents with travel brochures to go there because it portrays Holland as such a really relaxed country in that way, and that the crime is very low, and they also have, of course, gun control is strong there as well. I've not traveled to Holland, I don't know if anybody in here has, but
many years.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much true. I remember going into restaurants where they have a list of different kinds of hashish that they offer there that you can buy. People sit around, smoke dope in the cafes.
I'm not there yet in terms of legalization, mostly because I think Holland is a smaller country. It's, I think, a lot more homogeneous than what we are. And I just look at tobacco and alcohol, and they are still our number one drug problems.
Not so much legalization,
decriminalization,
yeah. Or making it like on a prescription basis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But getting it out of the hands of the gangster
element,
in terms of marketing.
I'm not sure how, if Holland is that homogeneous. It seems to be very racially mixed.
As much as our country?
Maybe I'm thinking the most gangster. Maybe.
Yeah.
People that I work with are involved in crime primarily because it requires so much to support their habit. Or some of them may have gotten involved in dealing because of the economic incentive. But were you going to make another point?
How's it work, JK? Living in a generation that really doesn't quite understand how rampant this is, and like among our high school kids and stuff. I mean, how does that work? I mean, everyone else in high school, we drink beer and stuff and party, but it just seems like this is so deliberate and so intense and so the drug use. I mean, they're trying to do something different. What motivates the kids to want to get into drugs who oftentimes come from families that are not economically poor? I mean, they've got a lot going for them sometimes. And how do they get them and stuff? I mean, give me an idea how that kind of works. I mean, why do kids do it, and how do they have access to it?
Well, I mean, first I want to say alcohol is still by far the number one problem on youth in our country. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I think sometimes we've overlooked alcohol and tobacco, but we've overlooked that, and sometimes it's been a justification for strategies that were really ill-conceived. But I don't know that I can answer that question. Can anybody else?
I'm not sure. You mean how do they get the drugs, or what?
I guess first of all, I think you're right about alcohol. Alcohol use seems to be so much more intense than it was when we were younger. I mean, it's starting earlier, it's more intense,
it's more available.
More available.
There's no doubt that the
more violence associated with it. I mean, we've had killings in Duluth and at parties that just had alcohol related things and teenagers, and I don't know, it just seems like even the alcohol part of it is so much more intense than it was before. I mean, what are the kids?
I think that's a fancy. That's my feeling. I think because I teach, but not those older kids, but I'm blown away from when I was teaching to now teaching at the university level what kids are involved with and what our teachers have to deal with. issue, because I, you know, I was in high school 20 years ago, and you know, some of the water polo team would go out and have their beers, and you know, it wasn't a major thing, and now, like you say, it's rampant, and I'm wondering if part of that's, I think part of it is related to a lot of the family things and the breakdown of family. I don't know, but I wonder why it's so different.
I think it's economic. I mean, well, first, there's two things. I think guns and alcohol are two different things. It's just that when they mix, it creates trouble. So that's two different things. But I think that, you know, the economy is such that both parents have to work, you know. And so that means that the kid is at home or without parent supervision for a lot of times and drifts into, you know, experimenting with drugs and stuff. But it's also, I mean, it's like when we were kids, it's very cool to do drugs and do alcohol. And you just get into it, it seems.
Well, I think a lot of it too is our society hasn't really figured out what to do with teenagers. Now, I've lived in the country a couple times in my life, and it's, in a lot of ways, a totally different atmosphere. That kids on farms have something to do from the time they're able to walk, where they're making a significant contribution to the family. And in fact, by the time they get to be 12 or 13 years old, they're taking on major responsibilities, you know, being able to do things by themselves, mm-hmm. riding tractor, and all sorts of fun things like that, that you don't get in the city or suburbs. Mm-hmm. There's just no opportunity like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like John today got to come up and help us clear trees. I bet you haven't done anything like that around your house, have you?
Mm-hmm.
Those opportunities don't exist. We don't make them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's very significant. I think that's very significant. And I think there's not that expectation of teenagers, young people, to do the things around the house. Our whole society is different, that she needs to do a lot for us. And so there is not that expectation for young people to work at home. You may get a job outside, but not at home. At the same time, you know, there is that sort of expectation on you that has been trained into them for instant gratification. For pleasure is an important aspect of our society. And how do you get pleasure fast?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we get through, people are finding that through drugs.
Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of, I think, fear and anticipation of the difficulties coming up that I think kids no longer feel much confident, and this goes across socioeconomic lines.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not at all sure they're going to get a job, not at all sure, you know, what, I mean, this is kids in affluent suburbs. They don't think they're going to find a job even if they go to college. And I think those diminished future expectations maybe reinforce the pleasure thing. Well, yeah, if I don't know what the future is going to bring, at least I'm going to have a good time now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's tough. And I think it's just simple things like kids now have to have a car.
Yeah.
And I watch just with like my affluent nieces and nephews, they'll end up living at home past the time they ordinarily would and being unhappy because they have to have the fast car, but then that's all they can afford to have.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't get a job that allows them to move out. But it's kind of like, it's so many elements. It's sort of, you know. And then I think it is a real spiritual emptiness, because when kids do get hooked into something, I think kids are really looking for meaningful things, that when there are things that are available, kids really do seem to grab hold on it. But I think the it seems like it's diminished opportunities for that meaningfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But I know people my age and younger who sit around and joke now about how much dope they used to smoke when they were in high school. But they were still functional. They went to class.
They thought they were.
They thought they were, but they still went to class.
They graduated, yeah.
They went to class, they graduated, you know, they came up.
They can't run for office now.
Yeah. They went to college, but, you know, there was a period there when all they did was smoke dope every chance they got. And I'm not sure where that, you know, where that comes from. I mean, the idleness you talk about. But these kids still had stuff to do. I mean, they did go to school and go to college. I don't know if they had to work, but they had other things. All of them had cars. You know, this is a lot of people. So, but the dope smoking was still an important part of their growing up.
Just to step back a minute and kind of lend a historian, a historical or kind of a sociological perspective, there's been regular, you know, cycles of expanded drug use in our country's history. And generally they have followed major national crises, like the American Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and then the 60s, of course, which most of us probably remember. And usually that expanded drug use is then followed by this intense intolerance, you know, of drugs. And some of the explanations for this are that it's related in some way to deeper institutional and, you know, ideological concerns. And it's really a question of how we choose to respond to that. And it seems that when expanded drug use has been the answer, rather than sort of strengthening our institutions and using government, family, church, society, et cetera, to address it, it's, you know, it's been worse. And then there's another fella who actually wrote a book, an article in Scientific American. Some of you, you know, subscribe to that. It's, I think it was in 91. He wrote Opium, Cocaine, and Marijuana in American History. And he sort of offers a little bit that the cyclical nature of drug use is due to sort of a learning curve and then subsequent kind of social amnesia where, first of all, a really small group, usually the elite, at first experiment with a particular drug, and that gets popularized and spread to the masses. And then there's sort of this sudden learning of the severe consequences of using it, and then the popularity declines, and then people sort of pull on and forget about how bad drugs are for a while, and then time passes, and then the cycle begins again. He maintains that that's been the case in our country for, you know, 200 years or more. So, you know, I ask the question, well, where are we at, you know, right now today? And I think we're sort of at one of those crises of whether we're going to strengthen some of our institutions, or, you know, we're going to have this rebound, or are we in an age of intolerance? I mean, we've also seen sort of this, you know, this DARE programs in schools and stuff like that. So,
I'm curious what the research is on.
It's not good.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not a proponent of that particular program, okay. But I also not. I can't say that I'm especially an expert on it at all, but I think there's so many other ways we could be.
I just wonder, to me, I mean, that's why I'm wondering what the research is. I haven't read it. It seems like it's a catchy phrase that makes some people happy, mm-hmm. but.
It's part of this whole other kind of approach that I was talking about, somewhat of a law enforcement.
Right.
And we know scare tactics have never, ever worked with addressing the drug.
Is there a certain element of using drugs by the law enforcement kind of as ways to tap unlimited resources? Like people will pump money into drug programs and as a way to get resources, the budget and stuff? Is there a certain element of that?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I know what you mean. But.
Well, I mean, you know, it's easy for the government to get money, you know, to raise taxes or whatever for drug programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, is there an element of it that is a sort of like a bottomless pit to collect money.
I mean, like, let's paint the picture as terrible so we keep on getting funded.
Yeah, because people are so paranoid about drugs, and so, you know, like you said, it's the biggest fear, and so people will pump money into it. And
yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, we certainly, like I said, dump lots of money, but it's all been in the wrong places. I mean, so very, very little has been into the areas we're talking about in terms of our youth and prevention and investment in human beings. It's been so much more this, you know, other approach.
But then it's been a source of money for military and law enforcement.
That
it may be pretty effective way to bypass.
Continue funding.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's a big part of the Coast Guard budget.
I'm sure.
Going into Congress regularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there how young are people using drugs now? Is it going? I know it's getting younger and younger, but what's the average age now?
Well, I mentioned yesterday, I mean, I don't know real, Verlon, I can't speak from knowing the sort of current statistics, but in the session yesterday, I talked a little bit about some of the drug trends, and just last week, the executive director at my agency came back from a meeting with the Seattle School District, where he had participated in a meeting. They do this national drug survey every, alcohol and drug survey every year that they've been doing now for, I think it's out of Michigan, which is the big sociological institute there. It's the same kind of questions that they've been asking kids for, I'd say 10 to 15, maybe longer years now. So it's they've got some really good data, and I can begin to sort of make comparisons. And the Seattle School District was becoming increasingly alarmed because they had kids as young as 13 reporting having fixed heroin. Now, and they were sort of like, you know, do we have to begin to even think about methadone treatment for, you know, teenagers or whatever? I think it is creeping down there, but I mean, I can only speak, I mean, that's only like a Seattle example. I don't know nationally what we're seeing. I mean, some things have come down, but in other ways, you know, it hasn't. I don't know. You're in the school, you said.
Yeah, but I teach at PLU, and I send student teachers into the field. So we talk at seminar, and they have problems. They kick fifth and sixth graders out of school with drugs. Now, sometimes that's no dose and, you know, over the counter things, but they're passing it. But that, I mean, it has really surprised me that that's happened at as young as fifth and sixth grade. And so, but I'm not sure how widespread that is, but it has trickled down to some of those lower, those intermediate grades, which I think is awful.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know statistics either about, but I know that was a big rationale for DARE. And mm-hmm. Now even, what is it, grade, the gang resistance? Awareness.
I'm not familiar.
I think there's another one. I think it's called GREAT, and it's gang resistant. It has to be education awareness. I don't know what the T is.
Mm-hmm.
But that, because they see it coming down to the elementary level, and I think the DARE program now is third grade even. I know they start.
I think it does go.
It does go to third grade because I was watching a student teacher teach, and I came in at the tail end of the DARE officer speaking, and I don't know enough about the program, but I thought, well, what's that gonna, I was real,
mm-hmm.
I haven't read a lot of positive things about it, and I know there haven't been any kind of research about what happens, the statistics for how effective they're seeing it, is it lowering percentages of drug use in the middle schools and high schools? People don't feel it is, and apparently there's a real reluctance for people to do that. Their people don't want that happening because I think they're afraid their program will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, that is too, that's what I've been reading, that there hasn't been a lot of long-term follow-up studies for DARE.
Mm-hmm.
And what there have been are
mm-hmm.
real positive.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't tell you how young, but I can tell you, you know, I have had student teachers come back and discuss it. So do you teach at the high school? You are used to the high school on this stuff.
Well, what you can do, I just want to, I don't like to leave people with sort of in their hands, you know. This is a really excellent resource that's put out by Fellowship of Reconciliation Task Force on Latin American Caribbean. It's available for $10. It includes lots of reflections, articles, and a whole series that's possible to do as a kind of a study group within a church or whatever. I think it's important to always keep having a dialogue in your own family or in other settings, your church or wherever, about your own thoughts about drugs and the roots of the drug crisis. And I think we can always have discussions around, you know, what kind of drugs do we use and what kind of messages do we give children around us, and maybe how drug use affects our own family or even our local community or church. I think it's always good to have, you know, challenging the media's presentation and, you know, in situations, really talking about how the media depicts the drug crisis. And also just talking about what values really are promoted in our society that contribute to drug use. I think those are all good entrees for, you know, giving attention to it and not kind of carrying putting on blinders. So,
is there an age when drug use takes a dip in terms of the population, where it stops, or does it go into prescription drugs or something at some point? I mean,
well,
I guess I'm asking it kind of like, is it kind of like once a drug use or sort of always a drug use?
Oh no. In fact, last week was reading an article that had divided, I think I mentioned this in the other session, divided adolescents up into total abstainers, experimenters, and people who regularly used in youth, and then they had followed them into adulthood. I don't know if adulthood, or at least maybe a few years later or something. And actually the experimenters in some ways had better psychological profiles than the other two groups. Now, one could make a lot of interpretations about that, but I think that it may speak to the issue that we need to sort of have this sort of moderate, you know, approach. But I mean, there's also many people who, like I say, experiment in their adolescence who never go on to, you know, regularly use. I mean, even the kind of people you were talking about that use marijuana or smoke, maybe in college or whatever. I'm not a proponent of, you know, experimenting, but I thought it was kind of an interesting perspective. So, okay.
I'm actually curious. I don't know what grade are you in? I'm going to 7th. You're going to 7th. Do kids at school talk that much about it? What goes, like, on the playground or?
When I was getting on the bus one day, kids are checking out books from the library on marijuana and that kind of stuff. And it's just people are kind of taking it as a joke that they're kind of liking it. Like they're saying they're thinking it's real cool. And then you would think that they'd be the kind of person that would do it.
Oh. So kids are talking about it more as a being cool kind of thing?
That's how they're acting.
Do you think they use it?
No. But our DARE teacher,
mm-hmm.
He told us that he had a student from where I was going, who was was asked to use drugs, and he used it in his skills, and it helped him.
He did use it there.
Yeah, so it worked.
And that's it, and a lot of the things they teach is saying no and resisting that pressure from friends. Is that
peer pressure?
Yeah, I think that's a valuable
yes.
approach. I just have some resistance to this sort of law enforcement sort of approach. I mean, I think that it's just one piece, I think, of a bigger kind of approach that needs to go on. I don't know. Well, I think we can come to an end. Thanks for your comments. It was fun to have some discussion. So. Thanks for coming. Yes, Dev's supposed to be here today. I was shocked. She'll be shocked to see me here.
Have you? So she does a whole show by herself?
I don't know if she's going to tonight. She always came in with another woman, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
I'm trying to think of her name now. She's really good.
But I don't know. It looks like she's kind of caught in the kind of arrival as the sheep, you know, the person's death that I was throwing a little cloud into the monster or something.